Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you, including our viewers, on C-SPAN 2. This is our first independent policy forum of the fall season. As many of you know, the Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures, debates, and panel discussions that we hold here at the Independent Institute's Conference Center in Oakland, California. As many of you may also know, the Independent Institute regularly sponsors programs like that on major social and economic issues, which might involve historical analysis or economic analysis or legal analysis, and involving top scholars and policy experts. Our program today is entitled The American Revolution and the Legacy of Liberty. Our speakers are the historians Joyce Appleby and Hans Eichholz. For those of you who have not seen their respective books, Joyce is the author of many books, the most recent of which is a book entitled Inheriting the Revolution, which we strongly recommend, has been widely praised in reviews around the country. Hans is the author of a forthcoming book, which unfortunately we don't have copies yet, but is entitled Harmonizing Sentiments, the Declaration of Independence and the Jeffersonian Ideal of Self-Government. Since the book is not available yet, will be available, I believe, in November, in your registration package, you'll find a form that you're welcome to use to order copies or placing orders upstairs. We'd be happy to send copies directly to you when they're available. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, you'll also find information about our program in your packet that you got when you registered. Or those who are viewing us can visit us at our website at www.independent.org. You'll find information about our many research and publication and conference and media programs. For example, on the website, you can listen to the audio files on Real Audio from past Institute events or read the transcripts on going back a number of years. You can also find articles and reviews about our quarterly journal, which is called the Independent Review. This is the current issue, and we are particularly interested at the Independent Institute and in the Independent Review on the topic of political economy, which relates directly to our topic tonight. To provide a little background on the Institute itself, we are a nonprofit, non-politicized academic public policy research institute. We sponsor many studies by leading scholars on a whole host of range of issues and publish the results as books and other publications and host events like this and many others. In your packet, you'll find information about upcoming events. The next one will be held on October 26th. That program is on the topic of public health versus the nanny state. The program will feature syndicated columnist Jacob Sullum, who's senior editor for Reason Magazine, and also author of the acclaimed book, For Your Own Good. And the program will also feature the economist Thomas DiLorenzo from Loyola University in Maryland, and co-author of the new book, From Pathology to Politics. We hope that you'll be joining with us at that time. The popularity of the recent movie, The Patriot, has sparked widespread debate over the real people, ideas, and events of America's revolutionary founding, and the meaning of all of that for the present. And with this fall's political contests, where demagoguery may well drown out any meaningful discussion of the principles of liberty, equality before the law, self-government, justice for all, and so forth, it is undoubtedly important that we take some time this evening to take stock and reflect on some of these principles and the history of how we got here. Otherwise, how can we decipher the many promises and the boasts and the charges and countercharges that we no doubt will be hearing between now and November and on into the future? In 1776, as most people here know, with the words, "Give me liberty or give me death," the remarkable firebrand and orator Patrick Henry sounded the keynote of the American Revolution. What many people don't know is that after the Revolution, Henry led many of his fellow anti-federalists in a fierce opposition to the Constitution's ratification in 1787 until it bore the amendments known today as the Bill of Rights. The anti-federalists were opposed to any attempt to impose a new centralized government that would impose the kind of rules or tyranny that Americans had so earnestly fought for against the British were imposing. To Patrick Henry, George Mason, and others, centralized rule from New York or Philadelphia or what later became Washington, D.C., was as heinous as that from London or any European capital. The Federalists, on the other hand, fearing an unregulated society of people, sought to impose a form of centralized, standardized authority through the Constitution. Hence the debate. The Anti-Federalists later learned that their fears were perhaps indeed justified, as the new federal government imposed taxes, sedition laws, and much more, and all of this led to the election of Thomas Jefferson as president towards the latter part of that century, and a struggle between the forces for centralized power against those for decentralized power, free association, and free trade, and much more. Although this incredibly bitter and portentous conflict happened over 2 years ago, 200 years ago, we see the very same issues and ideas at the heart of American politics today, and indeed worldwide. Such ideas as centralized power, devolved power, limited or unlimited government, individual rights, the power of vested interests, nationalism, slavery, secession, free migration, protectionism, revolution, mercantilism, individualism, democracy, and many other concepts are all wrapped tightly in this debate. A debate really of incalculably more significance than anything we are likely to see in this year's presidential or other political race. Mindful of these principles and these many contentious matters, the first generation of Americans after the Revolution reinvented themselves and their society. Was the Revolution a success? Yes, it was. But it was an incomplete revolution, as chattel slavery and the second-class status of women remained intact afterward. But this revolution of ideas launched what became a worldwide revolution for liberty in many respects, and the ultimate abolition of chattel slavery worldwide. Here was a time in a new world without feudalism, without political patronage and privilege, without the class system of the old world. Here Americans had created a dynamic, fluid society of innovation, experiment, enterprise, and movement. How exactly did their values transform politics, economics, and culture in this new republic? This evening, we will be discussing much of this and how it affected future generations. Before we do, however, I wish to take a few moments to pay a special tribute to a late departed friend, the brilliant historian, teacher, and author Henry Mayer. Henry was to be a part of this program this evening, but tragically he died suddenly of a heart attack while on vacation with his family in Montana. He was greatly looking forward to tonight's program, and we deeply miss losing him. Some of you may recall that Henry had spoken here last fall with the historian Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, who's also with us tonight. The topic then, this was last November, was the Civil War, Liberty and American Leviathan. Again, a very similar topic. At that time, Henry spoke based on his brilliant book, All on Fire, which is this book here, for which he was a National Book Award finalist. The book is on the topic of William Lloyd Garrison and the abolitionist movement. And incidentally, that particular program is also available on our website for those interested in listening or reading about it. You can go to our website and click on events and go directly to the program from November 17th. Henry had graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. and he earned an MA in history at the University of California, Berkeley. As I mentioned, he was a finalist in the National Book Award for his book, All on Fire. He also won the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize, the Boston Review's Rhea Prize for Nonfiction, the Commonwealth Club of California's Silver Medal for Nonfiction, and the New York Times Book Review Notable Book of 1998 for the book. This evening, Henry was going to discuss the subject of another of his books, and that book is this one called A Son of Thunder. It's a book on Patrick Henry and the American Revolution and the New Republic. This is a new edition of the book that just came out from the University of Virginia Press. He was also the co-author of the book As It Happened, and was working on a new book about the photographer Dorothea Land. A popular book critic, his reviews appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and many other publications. As I mentioned to some of you earlier, and as I promised Henry initially, we were going to make sure that we had copies of his books here, and it is indeed a pleasure to be able to make them available for those who are interested. For our program tonight, after the presentations by our speaker, we'll open up the program to discussion from our audience. Our first speaker is the historian Hans Eichholz, as I mentioned. Hans is senior fellow at Liberty Fund, a scholarly educational foundation in Indianapolis. He received his PhD in American history from UCLA in 1992, where he studied under Professor Appleby, and wrote his dissertation on the debates of the 1980s over the incorporation of the Bank of North America in Philadelphia. He has published and presented papers on various aspects of the political economic thought of the founding period, and has taught courses in American and world history at UCLA and California State University at Los Angeles. As I mentioned, his forthcoming book, Harmonizing Sentiments, will be out soon. It builds upon his work in political economy to argue that Americans during the Revolution had faith in their ability to be independent of Britain and the yoke of European tyranny because of the self-governing capacity of individuals in a free society. I'm delighted to present Hans Eichholz.
Thank you very much, David. I'm very delighted to be here before the Independent Institute and to give this presentation. I'm reminding myself this is not my dissertation defense. And so I shall persevere. It's a tough act to follow. The subject of Patrick Henry is an engaging one. I'm not an expert in that particular topic, and I know many of you were looking forward to a discussion of this particular patriot's life, and that would have been a very engaging and rewarding enterprise. I will do my best, however, to try to meld what I think are some of the most salient themes in A Son of Thunder with the themes in my own forthcoming work, Harmonizing Sentiments. How best to do that? I think I will simply talk to you about the odyssey that led me to write this work and why I set about to do it. That'll get you a sense then of what it is that I am trying to accomplish. I had a couple of concerns before setting out to write this. Two concerns that actually I didn't know originally were all that related. I knew they had some vague connection to each other. But exactly how it would all come together wasn't exactly clear in the initial process of writing the work. First off, I was very dissatisfied, but not quite sure how to approach what I considered to be a not all too satisfactory state of the historiography surrounding the nature of the American Revolution. I had a concern that it seemed that historians, after a long period of debate in which there was back and forth over whether the nature of the American Revolution was one of classical republicanism, in which people asserted the rights of, I should say, the the common good of the community over those of the individual and so forth, that it was more of an assertion of ancient virtues as opposed to individual liberty, versus those who argued that it was individual liberty and what you would call the classical liberal tradition or the Whig tradition, the old Whig tradition that informed the revolution. That was a debate that took up a long period of time, in which a number of others then came in and added their voice to that discussion. There were those who championed the notion that what was dominant, the dominant paradigm of the revolution, was a common law paradigm. There were those who argued that it was the Christian covenanting tradition that was the dominant paradigm, and a whole score of others. And what seems to have occurred in the last, 5-10 years, has been a growing consensus that Americans are somehow comfortable with paradox or comfortable with contradiction, that they held all of these different notions in their mind at once, that they were both Democrats and Republicans, that we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists, in a sense, and they seemed way too comfortable with that. So that there was very little sense that there might be a coherent tradition during the Revolution that inspired the revolutionary movement and informed the Declaration of Independence and even the Constitution later. So that was unsettling for me. The other was a long time concern or interest in the meaning of self-government. And this does have a lot to do with my mentor, Joyce Appleby, who wrote a very important article, The Radical Double Entendre in the Right to Self-Government. And in that article, she laid out very nicely how the meaning of self-government had taken on in the Enlightenment period and the period during the Revolution a new meaning that was not simply political independence or autonomy in the old ancient sense of the word going back to the Greeks, but actually embraced the concept of the individual as capable of governing him or herself, the individual as capable of personal self-government. And that struck me as always a very interesting transformation that I wanted to spend some time focusing on. The two concerns seem to converge when I, after reading a number of the works of Tom Paine, Common Sense, his essays on the rights of man, came across this emphasis on the state-society distinction. And it was especially brought together when I came across the work by Joshua Arielli that came out in around 1964 on individualism and nationalism in the early republic, I believe that is the title. I may have botched that a bit, but we can correct that later. And in that work, he noted that one of the things that seemed to trip up historians when they were viewing these early texts was that they tended to have a conception of government as primary and often confuse government and society, not keeping those two distinctions separate in their minds. And it struck me that these were actually tied very closely together to the debate, or the discussion, I should say, over the transformation of the term self-government. And that took me to looking at the various dictionary entries for the meaning of self-government. When I did that, I noticed something interesting. The earliest definitions of self-government, going back to Noah Webster's American English Dictionary and forward, listed self-government as government of the self, government of oneself, actually. It was very individual, very personal, focused on individual self-government. And there was actually no mention of the political. Now, it's not that Americans weren't aware of the political definition of self-government. What became clear was that, the political definition of self-government, of democracy, of republican government, was dependent upon the individual's capacity to govern himself in society. So I looked at how that changed over the years, and one of the interesting things was that after about the Civil War, the definition does begin to include, again, the political as a secondary definition. And actually, as late as the 1960s, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary unusual for a dictionary entry, made the second political definition dependent upon the personal definition. That is to say, it said government of oneself was primary, hence the right of a people to determine their own political future, democracy, etc. So that was an interesting change. But then, almost as quickly as that came in to the dictionary definition, it went out. And now one of the things that I notice is if you go to some of the more popular dictionaries, or if you go to the Merriam-Webster dictionary today, they've dropped hence. And in most of the desktop copies, what you will get is that personal self-government is listed as archaic, if it's listed as all, at all. And some of them will actually list only the political definition. So in a very interesting way, what we've done is we've gone from the We went from the ancient definition of political self-government to what, in Joyce Appleby's article, we understand to be the modern conception of personal self-government, to where today we have gone back to the political definition of self-government as primary. Now, part of, it seems to me, a historian's responsibility is to try to translate the textual remnants of the past into terms that can be readily understood today. And that can be a very daunting task when the historian, dealing in sources that are at least on the surface in the same tongue, the same language, his own native tongue or language, is faced with looking at words in a text that it's not so much that the definition per se has changed, but has subtly altered so that the emphasis is now political again rather than personal. Changes this perspective that you take when you read the text. So hence, what we get is all of these conflicts, it seems to me, that can't be resolved. Why is it that they held to so strongly to democratic forms of representation and yet worried so deeply about the rights of the minorities and so forth? How come they were so concerned with a Bill of Rights, for example? Why is it that these things could fit together in their cosmology of ideas? So that took me back to the subject of society. Well, how is it that the American patriots actually looked at order, social order? How did they conceive it? And what was it that they were thinking? Because one of the things that you notice when you read the Declaration of Independence is that it resonates with a certain confidence about man's capacity for self-government, about the human capacity for self-government, about Americans' capacity for self-government. So what is the conception there? And one of the things that I did then was to study the American Revolution in the context of the debate between patriots and loyalists. And a very interesting thing developed there. It's traditionally been asserted that, the current interpretation generally holds, the most popular interpretation generally holds, that these were different branches of the Whig tradition. They were just different by degrees. That is to say, loyalists and patriots simply had some basic disagreements over what were the proper representative institutions. In looking at the sources, what I came away with was that they had actually very fundamentally different views over how society operates. The loyalists gave themselves over in the Revolution to exclamations and denunciations, I should say, of the revolutionary movement because they feared anarchy and chaos. Samuel Seabury and Joseph Galloway and a whole host of other loyalists. This is what they began to write about and emphasize in their pamphlets, warning against the degeneracy of society that would occur if you lopped off the imperial head from its position of power in society, in colonial society. The patriots, by contrast, took a very different tack. And they argued from a number of different perspectives. And this is why it can lead to, this is another reason why it can lead to many conflicting interpretations of the nature of the American Revolution. They argued that actually there were many ways in which society was actually capable of self-government, in which there were mechanisms that gave order to society quite independently of political governance. It wasn't that they rejected political governance or that they felt government wasn't necessary. That's not the case at all. But it was a very small part of the overall equation. If we're to understand the richness of this tradition that they were drawing from, we need to understand all of the various aspects of their conception of society that drew upon this robust conception of order with many roots. One of them was custom and the common law. They made appeals to that, to the ancient constitution. They made appeals to the divine order of the universe. They made appeals to the capacity for rational self-interest. They made appeals to the ability for people to exercise their capacity for what you would call the moral sense, the other regarding feelings that the Scottish Enlightenment brought to the fore. A whole host of ways in which people were capable of governing their own actions in society. So when you talk about it in that respect, and also republican institutions and the ways to control for the abuse of power, all of these languages they drew upon. If you controlled the abuse of power, what would occur? Well, one of the things that I attempt to argue, and I try to present the evidence in the text, is that there would be a flourishing of civil society. And if you go back through the old texts of the old Whigs in England, in the 17th century and forward, one of the things that you will see constantly recurred to is the term happiness. Happiness of society, a happy society. You'll see it in Sidney, you'll see it in Locke, you'll see it in Trenchard and Gordon in their essays in the 1720s. You'll see it in the writing of international legal scholars like Emmerich de Vattel. And these were all sources that the revolutionaries drew upon. They were all familiar with them. And one of the terms then, happiness, describes this flourishing state of civil society in which people are able to give meaning and order to their lives through means other than simply politics. Politics is one part of the overall equation, but it isn't the dominant part. And that gets then right to the heart of what Tom Paine was talking about in his opening lines of Common Sense, where he made that radical distinction between government and society, where society works on us through our affections, and government is a punisher and for our transgressions. So that seemed then to bring together the various strands of the American Revolution that informed then the Declaration. So when we see nature and nature's God, we see a divine conception of the order of the universe in which very much a notion of the rational order of the universe is invoked, and that this is then translated into a conception of that order as it manifests itself in human society through life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Even common law injunction or the necessity that you state the case and present the evidence as brought forward in the explication of all of the grievances and so forth. And so you see all of these different strands coming together in the Declaration, and that's one of the things that I attempt to set out. That then, in a nutshell, is the overall program of the work. Now, in England, the Whig theory of society, this robust notion of social order as being ultimately self-regulatory, of an order that is what you might call parapolitical, that is, government is there in order to ensure that this flourishing takes place, but it is not necessarily considered to be the source of that order. In England, that was simply a theory. And the reason it was simply a theory is because always their Tory opponents, or after the 17th century, the new Whigs, to distinguish them from the old Whigs, who still held to a critique of power and still affirmed this robust notion of a natural social order, of a self-regulating social order, could always point, the Tories could always point to the king and to the supremacy of Parliament. They actually put government on new foundations. And so to the arguments of their opponents, they could always say, well, yes, but the order is actually there imposed by a supreme parliament or by the king in parliament and so forth. In America, and what I think gives the Jeffersonian tradition its real force, is that they could make they could appeal directly to the lived experience of Americans. Here it wasn't that these conceptions of a robust social order were simply theoretical. They were part of the lived experience of Americans. Americans had had very little interference from the British. And as we know from the work of Jack Green and others, that even in their own affairs, there was great liberty at even the local level. All of the assertions of colonial governments notwithstanding as to what their powers were, people were very much involved and engaged in Atlantic commerce. They were very much engaged in commercial agriculture. They were very much engaged in their various religious communities. What we see is a real thriving of the civil associational life, even in the late colonial period, that really becomes then spectacular in the antebellum period in terms of the number of associations and so forth that Tocqueville writes about. So what we then have in the American Revolution really is a foreshadowing of things to come. I do want to say now here that it seems to me when you read Son of Thunder, one of the things that comes out is, yes, he was very much engaged in the politics of his era, and certainly there was no better orator or speaker who could fire up his audience than Patrick Henry. But if you look at the richness of his life, if you look at all of the things that he was involved in, from his dealings in land speculation to his dealings with Presbyterian and Baptist dissenters to his obtaining that law degree to all the different things that he was involved in, you get a sense of just how rich the civil associational experience of Americans was, how rich their life was, and how rapidly, actually, things were improving and changing. And I think that that sets the stage fairly nicely for a discussion then of how things did turn out later when that first generation after the revolution attempted to continue to expand upon those revolutionary ideals. And if there are specific questions, I know there are a number of issues that I can address here, but I'd be happy to answer all of them. Like, I'm sure people will ask me about slavery, perhaps, or who knows what. I'm more than happy to address them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hans.